Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
I became very curious about this. So you were an advisor to the foreign ministry at the time, or
yes, there was a panel of people.
Okay,
a very heterogeneous panel, like very different people, and
the foreign ministry of Sweden.
Yes, during Carl Bildt.
Okay, I see the connection now. Yeah.
Did your? I'm curious whether your views, because you have, it strikes me at least, different views on developmental aid than Sweden had for a very long time.
Yeah.
Did your views and the government's views at the time diverge?
Not really. I mean, I think the problem was that, you know, it was a very heterogeneous group of people. And in the sort of aid space, you have kind of activists, you know, who only care about one thing. And you know, but when you're a kind of social scientist, you know, you're trying to trade off lots of things, and you know, but then you had people who were activists who were like trying to eradicate, you know, HIV in Africa, and then, you know, what should the Swedish government do? It should spend its entire budget on antiretroviral drugs in Africa. Okay. But then what about all the other things you don't spend money on, you know? So there's like no sense of trade-offs because they're just really motivated by this one issue, you know, which is great. But you know, you can't do it. If you're the government, you can't just do something like that. You have to think of all, and, you know, and it was just very complicated to reconcile all these different interests and these different ways of approaching what aid would be doing. I mean, my view about aid is that it's more or less irrelevant to development problems anyway, you know.
Like, okay, you're going to give a lot of Swedish politicians heart attacks by saying that.
Really?
Yeah,
I think
so.
It's in the book.
Yeah.
No, but if you could sum up your view, because I thought, I agree with you, and I thought it was very interesting, partly because it's very radically different from how Swedes think. So you're saying basically that developmental aid more or less kind of does not work for developing countries.
You know, I think humanitarian aid is extremely valuable. You know, if you have a crisis, you have famine, you know, you have drought, you can save lots of people's lives. I think, you know, you go into a village in Africa and there's a well, and the well was paid for by the Swedish government, and that's a good thing. You know, people have clean drinking water, and you know, that's a good thing. Does it solve the problems of those countries? No, of course not. No, I mean, it's not really designed to do that, if you want my honest opinion. So I don't think, some people think aid is the problem, that, you know, all this aid creates dependency and it creates corruption, and I don't think it's not the problem, but it's not the solution to the problem either, because it's not really addressing the problem. Mm-hmm. so So I think it's more or less irrelevant to development.
I was actually struck by what you mention in the book, that it's just about 10 to 20% of the aid money that actually reaches its target eventually.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of variation in that. There's some famous examples where the numbers are very low. Yeah, just when you do these, the World Bank, for example, does these things called public sector tracking surveys, where they try to figure out, oh, we gave $10 million for, you know, medical supplies in Sierra Leone. How much of it ever was spent on what it was supposed to be spent? And, you know, those things come up with pretty horrifying numbers, that most of the money disappears and you don't really know where it is. There's a famous study in Uganda. I think it's like 9% of money actually ever got to a school. It was a sort of school funding project. But, you know, there's a lot of differences there. So that, you know, there's examples where you have that.
But the countries that give the aid, they know that lots of the money will go to corrupt people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you have very limited ability to kind of monitor or control it once you've dispersed it, I think.
Isn't the argument like, well, it's better than nothing, at least we're doing something?
That makes you feel better, I suppose.
Exactly. I think that's what this business is about, really.
I think there's different sorts of pressure. I mean, I think if you look at Africa in the 1990s, you know, I think you do see examples of foreign pressure really kind of facilitated democratization. And so there's some very good examples, I think, you know, in Kenya, for instance, where the kind of international community, think about South Africa, and that's not exactly development aid, but the international community played a very positive role in, you know, getting rid of apartheid and creating democracy in South Africa and democracy in Kenya. And that was a good thing. It didn't solve all Kenya's problems by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a good thing. So I think there's not enough thought paid to kind of how you intervene, you know, and what instruments you use. You know, I always think, you know, outsiders can always play positive roles, you know, like, I mean, one of my friends in the United States is a sort of trade union activist, and he always says, like, union, you know, like, companies never spontaneously unionize, you know, somebody has to come from outside to kind of break the ice and sort of facilitate that process. You know, think of the civil rights movement in the US. You know, the civil rights movement was enormously aided by people coming from the North and, like, helping black people in the South organize and sort of deal with politics. And, you know, so I think outsiders are always useful, and outsiders can sort of disrupt equilibria, and they can have very positive roles. But I think not enough attention is paid to how do we do that? You know, what can we do? What role can we do? It's just like, there's the money. It's like a very out-of-date way of thinking about the problems for me. You know, it's just like, what's the difference between, you know, one of my friends calls it the F. Scott Fitzgerald theory of poverty. You know, this famous conversation between Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, which is like, you know, and Hemingway says, you know, the rich are not like us. And F. Scott Fitzgerald says, yeah, they have more money. and there's people with money and there's people without money. So how do you, you know, you just give them money, and but that, you know, that's not, yeah, but that's like treating the, it's just treating the symptom. It's not really treating the cause.
It was interesting because I've just like finished reading the book, and then there was an interview just a few days ago with our foreign aid minister, and he was basically reiterating more or less the same views about foreign aid that you have in the book, which is a very radical shift for Sweden,
yeah,
I would say. But if we, there's another thing I was curious about. If we take this this whole idea of foreign intervention and nation building, for example, like the U.S. adventures or misadventures in Iraq, yeah, and Afghanistan, they failed horribly.
Absolutely.
But it was also, so that made me very skeptical to nation building. But when I read your book and how the example of the French Revolution and how the French at the time basically dismantled a lot of institutions that were dysfunctional in other countries they invaded, uh-huh, and that succeeded, why did the US fail in what the...
Can we just quickly just go through the basic premise of the book? Okay. I know the book's been around for a while, but could you just go through a basic premise?
Yeah, so why nations fail? I mean, you know, why the title is also about success, of course, but I think for Daron and I, you know, my co-author, you know, we've always found failure more puzzling, you know, because if you study economics, it's all like completely straightforward. You know, there's no reason why anyone or any country should be poor. It's just very clear what you have to do. You have to save and invest and et cetera, et cetera. So like, we know what the recipe is. So like, you know, so if you know what the recipe for success is, how can there and like it just seems that being successful is much better than being unsuccessful. How come there is failure? So that sounds really silly when I say it like that, but that was always our kind of starting point. You know, like this is the puzzle. You know, this is what we don't understand, and so what's the difference between poor and rich countries apart from, you know, they. Rich countries have more money, and you know our view was just that's about how they're organized. You know, that's about the institutions of those societies. So by institutions, I just mean the rules. You know, that create kind of incentives and opportunities for people. You know, the legal system or the political institutions, but also kind of more informal institutions, also like social norms and practices. You know, which differ a lot in the world. So the argument in the book is that really the difference between poor and rich countries is that, yeah, it might be obvious what it takes to be rich, but in poor countries, institutions are organized in ways which just basically stop or disincentivize people from taking the actions that every economist knows make a society rich. So we sort of say, we put this very simple terminology on that. We say there's two sorts of institution kind of, you know, kind of packages, institutional packages. We call them like inclusive institutions and extractive institutions. And inclusive institutions are institutions that create broad-based incentives and opportunities, and extractive institutions create incentives and opportunities for narrow sets of people in society. Okay, that's in the kind of the economic sphere, you could say. But behind that is politics. You know, why is it that some societies have these inclusive institutions and others have extractive institutions? That's about politics. It's about political institutions and how power is distributed and used. And, you know, in some sense, you know, you can explain the whole book, you know, with this photograph, which I'm going to show this evening of like North Korea, the Korean peninsula at night, you know. And you see South Korea as a blaze of light and North Korea is like black, except maybe the sort of presidential compound in Pyongyang. He has a big wave machine. You know, it takes a lot of electricity to run a wave machine. So, but that tells you sort of everything. Like, why is South Korea so much more economically successful? Well, because there's incentives to invest in education, there's entrepreneurship, you know, there's amazing kind of dynamism, economic dynamism, capitalist, if you like, development. And, you know, and in North Korea, there's nothing, you know, there's no markets, there's no opportunities. It's a sort of totalitarian state, you know, in total poverty.
Yeah.
And it's sort of obvious that the difference between those kind of economic institutions is a result of the politics. You know, why is the economy organized like that in North Korea? Well, because it's a personalized dictatorship, basically. And in South Korea, it's just a much more open, fluid, you know, we don't use the word democracy too much because we want to talk about these historical examples, and it's a bit anachronistic talking about democracy in the modern sense if you're talking about, you know, medieval Venice or something, right. some African, you know, some pre-colonial African society. So but, you know, that's obviously that's connected to political inclusion.
So is it fair to say that the book implicitly or sometimes even explicitly kind of rejects the idea of cultural determinism or geographical determinism?
Absolutely. So that's what's interesting about the Korean example. You know, I'd say that was a natural experiment in the sense that, you know, at the end of, you know, sort of after the Second World War, Korea gets split into these radically different societies. But they're culturally, historically very homogeneous, you know. So and it's geographically homogeneous also. So you're sort of holding constant these cultural and geographical arguments. In the book, you know, you have to keep things very simple to write a book like this. So, you know, we kind of try to clear out these other potential hypotheses at the start. I think this whole business of culture is very complicated. You know, culture is very badly studied by social scientists, especially economists. It's much better studied by sociologists, for example. You know,
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You know, I would say there are enormous cultural differences in the world. But what you see is, you know, you can create modern prosperous societies in very different cultural situations. You know, think about Japan. You know, Japan modernized and it created an extremely prosperous society, maintaining many of its old, you know, cultural... I mean, Japan is not like Western Europe culturally at all. So I think, you know, I think it's complicated. That's something that's... Professor Acemoglu and I are studying a lot, actually, at the moment, is how to think about these sort of cultural differences and what's the right concepts for thinking about culture. I mean, I work a lot in sub-Saharan Africa. I just spent the summer in Nigeria. And, you know, obviously, Nigeria is extremely different culturally from, you know, from North America or Western or, you know, England, where I grew up. How does that matter for economic development? And I don't know what the answer is at the moment. I enjoy it a lot, you know.
Can you give any examples of these inclusive institutions that you talk about?
Yeah. So I think like one example, you know, so the Korea, South Korea, North Korea, you know, one example that I think is very powerful typically when I talk about this is, you know, we end the first chapter by talking about the difference between Bill Gates and Carlos Slim, who were the two richest people in the world at the time we wrote the book. And, you know, so how they got their money, you know, they're both incredibly rich. How they got their money is extremely revealing. So Gates got his money through innovation. Okay, so here's an example of an inclusive institution, which is the patent system. So Gates had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of patents. So he innovated. What do you do when you create an invention? Well, you take out a patent to try to protect your intellectual property rights, because an idea, you create an innovation, you create a kind of idea. And then once you create that, other people can borrow it. So that generates wealth for yourself, maybe, but it generates wealth for other people. So the idea of a patent is you kind of protect your intellectual property rights, you stop other people borrowing your idea so you can make more wealth. And that sort of aligns your incentives with the social incentives, you know, for innovation. So Gates innovated, okay? What did Carlos Slim do? You know, Carlos Slim got his friends in the government to privatize unregulated, to him, you know, the telecom monopoly, okay? So Gates, you know, think of that idea of sort of innovation. Like Gates became fabulously wealthy, but he generated all these ideas. You know, he sucked other people, talents into the computer industry. What did Slim do? Slim did the opposite. You know, he kind of excluded all competition, you know, and he overcharged Mexicans, you know. And the losses are huge. Like the calculations of the losses from that monopoly are enormous, you know, far about twice the size of, at least twice the size of Slim's fortune. So it's exactly the opposite. Instead of like enriching other people, it was impoverishing other people. But why do you get those two different things? Well, not because of culture or not because, you know, of differences in personalities or good guy, bad guy. No, they're both like super clever, you know, entrepreneurs. But the thing is, the way to make money in the United States is very different from the way to make money in Mexico. Why is that? Because of the institutions. Because in the US, the institutions push you in the direction of innovation. It push you in the direction of activities which are socially desirable. And in Mexico, it's the opposite. Okay, and you know, that example is nice also because when you get into it, you sort of see what kind of institutions are important. And in that case, you know, and the, you know, the nicest example is like, of it's not good guy, bad guy, is that, okay, Carlos Slim was a monopolist. Did Bill Gates want to be a monopolist? Of course he did. He tried like crazy to be a monopolist. You know, Microsoft was found guilty of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act, you know, and Bill Gates was dragged into court and, you know, was dragged to Washington, D.C. to give testimony. So there you have, that's, what's that? That's enforcing the institutions. It's the state having the capacity to enforce, you know, the antitrust laws or to enforce patent laws and stop people stealing other people's ideas. So that's another part of the of a kind of inclusive political institutions. It's the kind of the capacity of the state. They have great antitrust laws in Mexico. You know, I know the people who wrote them, but the government can't enforce antitrust laws on Carlos Slim. Impossible.
So I thought that was very interesting because you're talking about how to be a successful nation is talking about patent and innovation and so. Some people, I don't know if you have heard this, but are there people who are saying that, but what about human rights and democracy? Isn't that also a big part of being a successful nation?
I think it is, you know, because I think that's a big part of, you know, what it takes to be inclusive. Like, but for us, you know, the politics is more fundamental than the economics, you know. So, you know, you don't get an inclusive economy at the whim of a dictatorship. You know, that's the problem in China. You know, you need to have political power, political rights, you know, inclusive. You know, that's what generates an inclusive economic institution. That's what generates, you know, pressure to get rid of monopolies, pressure to open things up to people. So I think, yes, that's you know, we care about that intrinsically, but it's also key for an inclusive economy that to have rights and democracy. And, you know, we've done a lot of scientific research on what's the impact of democratization on economic growth and public good provision. And, you know, and I think the evidence is overwhelmingly positive. Of course, the difference in living standards between, you know, Gabon and Sweden, you know, part of it is explained by the fact that, you know, Gabon is not a democracy and Sweden is, but there's lots of other things going on too.
If we go back to, because I'm still very curious about this specific question, why did the US fail in Afghanistan and Iraq? While the French, after the revolution, succeeded in dismantling extractive institutions in other countries in Europe. Is there something?
So, I mean, you know, I think it's a very different kind of world historical moment. I think the US completely failed to understand what it would take to create legitimate political institutions in a place like Afghanistan or Iraq. They didn't understand enough about the society, about the culture, you know, about, they just didn't know what they were doing. You know, they just had this extremely naive idea of, you know, liberal democracy is a great thing for everybody. And, you know, and so I just think like it's, you know, you need to have a legitimate political system. I think if you go back and you think about what happened in the Napoleonic Wars, that's this moment, you know, in world history where, you know, you have this enormous impact of the Enlightenment, of these kind of philosophical ideas, you know, both in France itself, but throughout kind of Western Europe also, you know. So there were many Enlightenment intellectuals in Germany, you know, who embraced the French Revolution. And
it was partly cultural.
Or, you know, ideological, cultural. I think it's a moment where people were sort of rethinking their political institutions. You know, they were rethinking. And of course, there was a lot more similarity between absolutist political institutions in France and absolutist political institutions in Prussia or whatever it is. Right. You know, so that's also very different, you know, than the context where the Americans have this model of democracy that they think is wonderful, but it's very calibrated to the US, and suddenly you plonk it down in Kabul in a completely different, where everything, the challenges are different, you know, like people's ideas are different, you know. So, you know, Afghanistan had never been governed, you know, ever historically in the way the US intended it to be governed, for example. You know, if you read any history of the Afghan state, you'll read that, like, nobody ever collected taxes, you know, outside the river valleys. You know, like, the relationship between the kind of the state and, I mean, it's just not like a Western state historically at all, I think.
I'm from Afghanistan. Yeah. And yes, we don't have a centralized power. It's, you know, it's clans ruling in different parts of Afghanistan.
Right.
And you don't have, you know, some Afghans, a lot of Afghans will say, what do you mean Afghan? I'm Pashtun, you know, I'm Hazara, I'm Uzbek. They don't have anything in common with other Afghans, they will say. So it's a very split country. And to have one man deciding, people will say, where is he from? What are his interests?
But I mean, if you take the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, because after the invasion, what they tried to do was to install Western democracy in that country. So in what sense isn't that the idea of taking a political institution and putting it there without taking culture into account? Because as you kind of also said, there is a cultural problem there, right? So what's the role of culture in this case?
Yeah, I don't know it's a problem. I mean, there's cultural differences, I guess. And you have to, I mean, that's part of the reason why we use this word inclusive also, you know, because societies can be extractive in very different ways and they can be inclusive in different ways as well. So I think, you know, that's whereas when you say democracy, you tend to immediately think of a very specific set of institutions, which I, you know, I said earlier, I think that's kind of a bit anachronistic historically.
Yeah.
But maybe in this context also, you know, like it's going to be like, you know, what's going to be a legitimate sort of, you know, I don't think the notion of inclusion, it's not a Western idea, you know, I mean, nor is democracy for that matter, you know, like democracy was invented loads of times in lots of different societies, you know, historically and you know, so I don't, you know, that, but it's institutionalized in different ways, you know, and I guess, you know, inclusion can be institutionalized in different ways. And I just think, like, trying to spread your model of inclusion to other parts of the world, you know, didn't.
Okej. Okay. Du har lyssnat så här långt. Pozista måltid. En mycket fin radioprogram i Sverige. Du tycker det är mycket trevligt. Men, lyssna på mig nu. Det här var inte hela avsnittet. Det var bara en liten smakprov. Hela avsnittet är nämligen mycket längre. Om du vill lyssna på alla hela avsnitten, då du måste betala biljet på klubbista måltid. De har grabbarna dom behöver pengar. Flis, lax, stolar, forad betalar kningar, shopa blood pudding till familjen, oka tunnelbana, eller drika en kal norland z guld poute serviering i bland. Les i beskrivning for avsnit, dar de fins information forad bli medlem po klubzista moltit. Det kostar somet par kafe late ute potoriet. Per monat. Somet pakieter biudande, helt enkelt. Let some men plat. Tak, minwen.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.